It was only then, in the moment of losing him, that he realized that he was, after all, just another father. For the first time in his life, he acknowledged his love and dependence upon that love. He loved his son, and he was losing him. He groaned in anguish. Then rage boiled up in him and burnt away all other feeling. It was a consuming anger against all those who had inflicted this loss upon him. He stared into the empty darkness that had swallowed his son, and the fire of vengeance burnt through every fibre of his being. He wanted to shout this fury after them. He wanted to rail against the woman. He wanted to curse and scream out his frustration. But he caught himself. That was not his way. He must be cold and sharp as steel now. He must think clearly and with icy purpose. The first thought that came into his mind was that he had lost his hold on Red Rose. She was no longer of any value to him, or the cause. Now she was the sacrifice. He knew how to destroy her, and all those around her. The hilt of the weapon was in his head. It only remained to unsheathe it. He pushed off from the mangrove and let the tide sweep him into the curve of the river, swimming across it with an easy breaststroke. The bottom shelved gently under him, and he touched sand and waded ashore. Raleigh Tabaka was waiting for him beside the burnt-out ruins of the communications centre. Ramon dressed hastily in borrowed trousers and jacket. His hair was still damp and matted with river mud. Smoke from the smouldering buildings hazed the first grey light of dawn. Raleigh Tabaka's men were recovering the corpses and laying them out in a long row under the palms. In rigor mortis they were locked into the attitudes in which they had met their deaths. It was a grotesque charade show. José, the paratrooper, had one arm thrown over his face, as though protecting his eyes. His chest was mangled by grenade shrapnel. Adra's arms were extended as though she hung on a crucifix, and half her head was missing. Raman glanced at her without particular interest, as he might at a worn-out article of clothing, which no longer had any utility for him. "How many?" he asked Raleigh Tabaka. 26, he replied. "All of them. There were no survivors. Whoever it was, they did a thorough job. Who were they, do you know? Have you any idea?" "Yes," Ramon nodded. "I have a very good idea." And before Raleigh could speak again, Ramon told him. "I am taking over the Syndex project, personally." "A comrade general," Raleigh frowned with affront. "That has been my operation from the very beginning. I have controlled the two brothers." "Yes," Ramon agreed implacably. "You have done very well. You will receive all the recognition that you deserve, but I am taking over the direction of the project. I will leave for the south as soon as an aircraft is available. You will accompany me." "It doesn't end here, Bella," Shaza said gravely. "We cannot just pretend that nothing else happened. I did not want to complicate the rescue attempt by considering the full murky depths of this whole dreadful business. However, now Nicholas is safe here at Veltefrieden, we are forced to do so. Many people, including the members of your family, risked their lives for you and Nicholas. One gallant young man, a stranger, a trooper of Sean's regiment, died to save you. Now you owe us the truth." They were assembled in the gunroom once again, and Isabella was on trial before the family. Her grandmother sat in the chair on one side of the fireplace. She sat very straight. Her hand on the ivory head of her cane was blue-veined beneath the thin parchment of skin. Her hair, once a thick, unmanageable bush, was now the purest silver cap washed with a hint of blue. Her expression was severe. "We want to hear it all, Isabella. You will not leave this room until you have told us every detail."
"Nana, I'm so ashamed. I had no choice."
"I did not ask for excuses and self-abasement, Missy. I want the truth." "You must understand, Bella. We know that you have done terrible damage to the national interest, to the family, to yourself. Now it is our duty to contain and control that damage." Shaza stood in front of the fireplace, with his hands clasped under the tails of his blazer. His tone had moderated. "We want to help you, but we must know the truth before we can do so." Isabella looked up at him with a hunted expression.
"Can I talk to you and Nana alone?"
She glanced at her brothers. Gary lolled in the armchair under the window with thumbs hooked in his gaudy braces. He rolled an unlit cigar from one side of his mouth to the other. Sean sat on the windowsill, his legs thrust straight out in front of him. His bare arms, tanned and sleek with muscle, were crossed over his chest. "No," said Santin firmly. "The boys have risked their lives for you and Nicky. If you have stored up more trouble for yourself and the family, there are the ones who will be called upon to bail you out. No, you don't get out of it that easily. They deserve to hear everything you have to tell us. Don't leave anything out. Do you hear me?" Slowly, Isabella lowered her face into her hands.
"They gave me the code name Red Rose." "Speak up, girl. Don't mumble." Santin banged her cane on the floor between her feet, and Isabella started and looked up. "I did everything they told me to," she said, looking the old lady in the face. "When Nicky was still an infant, just over a month old, they made a film and showed it to me. They almost drowned my baby. They held him by the feet and ducked him." She broke off, and then drew a deep breath to steady herself. "They warned me that in the next film they would cut off parts of his body, and then send them to me. His fingers, his toes, his arms and legs, and then—" She choked on the word. "And then his head." They were all silent and appalled until Santin spoke.
"Go on."
"They told me I must work for Daddy. I must inveigle myself into his arms corps work." Charzo winced, and Isabella twisted her fingers together. "I'm sorry, Daddy. They told me that I must enter politics, stand for Parliament, use the family connection."
"I should have suspected your sudden political aspirations," Santin said bitterly.
"I'm sorry, Nana."
"Don't keep saying you're sorry," Santin snapped. "It does not contribute anything worthwhile, and it is damnably irritating. Just get on with it, child."
"For a while they asked nothing of me, for almost 2 years. Then the orders started to come. The first was the Siemens radar chain."
Charza grunted and was about to speak. Then he checked himself and reached for the handkerchief in his breast pocket of his blazer.
"Then they wanted more and more."
"The Skylight Project?" Charza asked, and when she nodded, he glanced at Santin. "You were right, Mater." He looked back at his daughter. "You will have to write it all down, everything you ever gave them. I want a list, dates, documents, meetings, everything. We must know everything that is compromised."
"Daddy," Isabella began. And then for a moment she could not go on.
"Spit it out, Missy," Santin ordered.
"Syndex 25, Isabella said.
"Oh, God, no," Charza breathed.
"That was why they gave me access to Nicky this last time. The Syndex specifications. And Ben."
"Ben?"
Gary straightened up in his chair.
"Who is Ben?"
"Ben Gama," Santin said harshly. "Tara's little black bastard. The son of Moses Gama, the man that killed my Blaine. The man that disgraced his family." She looked at Isabella for confirmation.
"Yes, Nana. My half-brother, Ben."
She looked at her brothers.
"Your half-brother, too. Only he doesn't call himself Ben Gama now. He calls himself Benjamin Africa."
"Why do I know that name?" Gary asked.
"Because he works for you," Isabella said. "They made me arrange a job for him. I recruited him for Capricorn when I was in London. He works for Capricorn Chemicals as a laboratory technician in the poisons division."
"In the Syndex plant?" Charza asked with disbelief. "You didn't get him in there?"
"Yes, Peter, I did."
She was about to apologize again, but then looked at her grandmother's face. Gary leapt out of his chair and strode to the desk. He seized the telephone and spoke to the operator on the Feltefrieden exchange.
"Get me a call to Capricorn Chemicals. You've got the number, haven't you? I want to speak to the managing director immediately. It's urgent, very urgent. Call me back here the moment you have him on the line."
He replaced the telephone.
"We'll have to have him, Ben. We'll have to have him taken in for questioning right away. If they placed him in the plant, it was for some good, or rather, for some nefarious reason."
"He is one of them," Santin burst out. None of them had ever heard such bitterness in her tone, or seen such hatred on her face. They all stared at her in horror.
"He is one of the revolutionaries. the Destroyers, with that Black Satan as his father, and Tara to poison his mind over all the years, he must be one of them. God grant that we can prevent whatever terrible thing that they are planning.
They were all of them subdued by the horror of their imaginings. The telephone split the silence, and Gary snatched up the receiver.
I have the managing director of Capricorn on the line.
Good, we'll put him on.
Hello, Paul, thank God I've got you.
Hold on one second. He pressed the conference key on the telephone so they could all listen to the conversation.
Listen, Paul, you have an employee in the poisons division.
The new pesticide plant. Benjamin Africa.
Yes, Mr. Courtney, I don't know him personally, but the name is vaguely familiar.
Hold on, let me get the computer print on him.
Yes, here we go. Benjamin Africa, he joined us in April.
Okay, Paul, I want him arrested and held by the company security guards. He is to be held completely incommunicado. Do you understand that? No phone calls, no lawyers, no press, nothing.
Can we do that, Mr. Courtney?
I can do anything I want to, Paul. Bear that in mind. Give the order for his arrest now. I'll hold on while you do it.
It will take 2 seconds, the managing director agreed.
They heard his voice in the background as he spoke to security over the internal circuit.
All right, Mr. Courtney, they're on their way to get Africa.
Now listen, Paul, what is the position with the Syndex manufacturing program? Have you started to ship to the army yet?
Not yet, Mr. Courtney. The first shipment is due to go out next Tuesday. The ordnance are sending their own trucks.
Okay, Paul, well, what stocks are you holding at the moment?
Let me check the computer.
Paul's voice was starting to betray his agitation.
At the moment, in the 5-kilo artillery canisters, we have 635 each of Formula A and B. In the 50-kilo aerial cylinders, we've got 26 of each of both the formulas. They'll go to the Air Force at the end of next week.
Gary cut him off.
Paul, I want a physical count of every canister and cylinder. I want some of your senior men in the storage area right away to check the serial numbers of each piece against the plant manifest, and I want it done within the next hour.
Is something wrong, Mr. Courtney?
I'll tell you that when you have the results of your stock take for me. I'll be waiting at this number. Come back to me as soon as you can, or come back a damn sight sooner than that.
As he hung up, Sean demanded,
How soon can you get us to Capricorn?
Well, the Lear is out of action. DCA want a full overhaul of the airframe and a new airworthiness certificate after that missile strike.
How soon, Gary?
Sean insisted, and Gary thought for a second.
The Queen Air is so slow, but it'll be quicker than waiting for the scheduled flight to Johannesburg. At least we'll be able to fly directly to the airstrip at the Capricorn plant. If we leave in the next hour, we could be there early this afternoon.
Well, shouldn't we notify the police? Shaza asked, and Santon banged her stick imperiously.
No police, not yet. Not ever, if we can help it. Grab Tara's black bastard and beat the truth out of him if we have to, but we must try to keep this in the family.
She broke off as the telephone rang. Gary picked it up and listened for a few seconds. Then he said,
I see. Thank you, Paul. I'm flying up right away. I should be at the Capricorn Strip by 1 this afternoon.
He hung up and looked around their anxious faces.
The little bird has flown. Benjamin Africa hasn't showed up at the plant for the last 4 days. Nobody has heard from him. Nobody knows where he is.
Oh, what about the stocks of Syndex? Shaza demanded.
They're checking them. They'll have the results when we land at Capricorn, Gary told him. Pater and Nana must stay here at Veltefrieden to liaise at the send.
If you need to get a message to us while we're in the air, you can telephone information at Jan Smuts Airport Control and get them to relay. He looked across at his brother.
Sean will come with me. I might need some muscle.
Sean sauntered across to his father and held out his hand.
Keys of the gun safe, please, Pater.
Shaza handed them over, and Sean turned the lock on the heavy steel door and swung it open. He stepped into the safe and studied the rack of revolvers and pistols for a moment before he selected a .357 Magnum Smith & Wesson revolver. He took down a packet of ammunition from the shelf above it and thrust the revolver into the belt of his jeans.
Well, I'd better take one as well. Gary went to the safe.
Gary, Isabella called after him. I'm coming with you and Sean.
Forget it, Mavourneen.
Gary didn't even look around, as he selected a Heckler & Koch 9mm Parabellum from the rack. There's nothing further that you can contribute.
Yes, there is. You don't know what Ben looks like. I can recognize him. And there's something else I haven't told you yet.
What is it?
I'll tell you when we're in the air.